your work life, your relationships, your money, your health, the meaning of life. Welcome to How to Do Life with Marty Nemko.
Well, today's topic is one I wish I wasn't quite as qualified to talk about, and that's aging. I just turned 70 years old, and hopefully I still have enough marbles left that I can offer something of value, although I really wish I was 30. I think that all this crap about calling getting older the golden years, even if you're healthy, and frankly, my doctor says I'm perfectly healthy at this point, but, you know, calling them the golden years, you know, or you acquired wisdom. Well, you know, as Neil Simon said, wisdom doesn't necessarily come with age. Wisdom comes with wisdom. Some people are simply wiser than others. But I'd like to think that I'll be able to talk with you today about some things that will be useful to you if you're younger and you've got aging parents, or at some point you are trying to think about whether your being older could open the door to some careers that are particularly, or jobs that are particularly advantageous to you if you're older. Then talk about a succession plan, dealing with your own decline. We'll talk about that. What else here do I have on my list? I have nothing scripted. I never script, but let's see. Yeah, a few upsides of aging. I think I'll talk about those up front. Then the crappy part, the pain of dying, the fear of dying, loss of sex drive, and then facing the end. So hopefully that should be a rich 28 and a half minutes. And so let's start with, I really wish I could just reverse it. You know, wouldn't it be great if I could do a show and say, hey, we're going to talk about aging and how to reverse it? Well, you know, there's a little bit we can do. Stay skinny, you know, the usual. Don't smoke, don't drink to excess, don't do drugs to excess. keep your stress down, you know, take your medications, see the doctor. But, you know, it's not going to reverse aging. It'll just slow it some. So we're not going to talk about that. Let's start with, I want to do chronologically. So I'm assuming that right now I'm talking to people who are a little younger, and they may have aging parents. Perhaps non-obvious thoughts that might be relevant to you is your aging parent is going to little by little become a different person than the parent you knew. They always talk about the second childhood. And it's easier said than done, of course, as is much of what I'm going to say here. But thinking of them as indeed a different person, approaching already in their second childhood, can help you develop the unfortunately necessary patience to deal with an aging parent. You know, and I think this is another important point. You know, when you're still in the prime of your life, your 40s, your 50s, even your 60s, there is a feeling that, oh my God, I'm guilty. I should be spending more time with my parent. For what it's worth, I think if you can bring them back, great. If you can slow their aging, great. But many people will spend the time in the prime of their life depriving themselves of much of their life in their prime to do of something that's of fairly little value to the parent ultimately, other than making them feel good. I would, you know, Father Nemko, Rabbi Nemko, Imam Nemko, wants to absolve you of that. Yes, do what you feel is appropriate, but you shouldn't feel guilty if you want to have a life yourself. I've seen too many people in their 50s sacrifice their careers and much of their own life to take care of an aging parent with not enough benefit. Of course, another disadvantage that you, if you've got an aging parent, you become more aware of your mortality. You know, we like to be the queen of denial because it doesn't do much good to think about our inevitable end. We're all on the same conveyor belt with the same endpoint. It's just a matter of whether you fall off early or not and in how much pain. But seeing your parent aging reminds you of your own mortality. And the best I can say is the only silver lining in that is that you can, at least it makes you aware, because of our time is finite, trying to squeeze as much productivity and or pleasure, depending upon your value system, from the for each moment. And the final thing I want to say about you with your aging parent is after they die, there is no one right way to grieve. There are some people who find they need to do a lot of processing and take months, if not even longer, to get over the loss of a parent or even a spouse. Yet other people while they may have loved their parent very much, or maybe not so much, are quickly able to move on as soon as it's not unseemly to do so. This is not a time when your parent goes for you to adhere to social norms beyond the most, you know, the basic minimums. If you feel like you're ready to move on, fine. If you do feel that more processing will help you, then fine. But do recognize that generally, I have found that among my clients, that the more people process, the longer they explore it and revisit their parents and nostalgia about the good times, beyond a very minimum amount of that, it tends to keep the sadness top of mind. I think there's a reason in the Jewish tradition they have something called Shiva, which is for 7 days. You stay at home and you invite your friends and family to come over and reminisce and talk about your lost one. And then the 7 days is over. Not that they're expecting you to jump up and go back to immediately your life, but the notion is that shorter may be better for most people. Now I want to turn to succession. Now we're not talking about our parents anymore, we're talking about ourselves. At some point, whether it be even as early as your 50s, but it could be in your 60s, 70s, or 80s, as my father, he worked until he was 82. Passing on what you know to the next generation, perhaps choosing your replacement or whatever, is among the better things you can do. Like I said, I just turned 70, and I'm grateful that I'm still in great health. But I'm aware it doesn't last. Especially men, we die 5 years younger than women, and 95% of all of the gender-specific healthcare for the last 60 years has been done on women. I did a review of PubMed, which indexes 3,000 medical journals, and that is true. 95% of all the gender-specific medical research has been done on women. And most of the health agencies are on women, even heart disease, which kills men much earlier and younger. There's endless initiatives about women in heart disease, breast cancer, far more than about prostate cancer, even though men die so much younger. But I digress. It's not quite on topic. So, but at some point, you're going to be aware that you are going to need to pass the mantle. And as I said, I am now 70, and I have made efforts to reach out to find somebody who I could train to be my successor as a career counselor. I did two things. I placed an ad in a local publication that serves an intelligent and kind readership. Those are the two most important attributes in who I'd replace. Not as important that they'd be a counselor. They're just that they're kind, intelligent people who have good ethics and have the gift of transforming people. By the way, if you know somebody like that, I welcome their emailing me at mnemko@comcast.net. That's mnemko at comcast.net. Anyway, and I also, I emailed the 8 people on planet Earth who I know, who I most respect, and asked them to refer a possible person, a candidate, to be my, you call it, intern, apprentice, whatever you want to call it. So it is pretty important to do that, so that whatever you've learned over these zillion years doesn't go with you to the grave. And it just feels good. It's part of what Eric Erickson called the transgenerativity part of life, where you just try to pass it on to the next generation. And apart from your own selfish desires, it's good for the world. Even if, you know, it doesn't matter, even if you're a clerk, and you've been a clerk, but you're, you know, you've learned a lot about the art of clerkdom over all these years, and finding somebody to train to be a great clerk. You know, for example, let's say you know somebody who's not very academically oriented, is a young person, maybe fresh out of high school. Teaching them the art of being an amazing clerk could help that person become employed when otherwise they might just, you know, have a much worse job than a clerk, you know, a ditch digger or whatever. What else? Okay, now how do you deal with your own decline psychologically? First of all, I mean, as I use the little cliche, the queen of denial, I mean, it's really true, because no matter what upsides there are, you have more wisdom, you've got more time, you can savor the coffee, you can drink, savor to smell the roses, you have more time with the grandkids. All that's well and good, but it doesn't compensate for the fact that you are ever less capable, less physically able, more likely to have aches and pains, if not worse. So, you know, in the end, staying busy being in denial, not thinking about it, and as soon as it enters your brain, distract yourself and get busy. That may be the single best way to deal with your own decline. But that all said, I guess I do want to say something about, I'm going back a little bit. I had promised you that I was going to talk about some careers that being older is a plus. So I want to talk about that just a little bit. Because there are many careers in which they're not allowed to legally do it, but they definitely prefer younger people. So one example, the most obvious, and I know that the people of you who are listening to this on public radio tend to be liberal, and so I want to talk about fundraising. There is a perfect example of a career that in which being older is a plus. Most people, by the time they've accumulated enough money to donate a significant amount, are older, and they feel more comfortable donating to a person who is an older person who's representing an organization. So there's a perfect example of an age-friendly career. On the other side, of course, you know, fundraisers are basically salespeople. On the for-profit flip side of that is a sales representative. And again, older people have more money, so they're more likely to afford luxury cars, boats, assisted living, of course, even something that's less obvious like architectural services. Also insurance, of course, long-term care insurance, life insurance. People tend to not think about life insurance till they're older. So those are items where being older is a plus. I want to talk about other ways to distract yourself from about aging that are not just distracting yourself being with the grandkids. I have a client who found, and not, you know, volunteering. Obviously, volunteering is a great thing that many older people do. But this guy did something very interesting that I never in a million years would have thought of. He started collecting things. And there were obvious things you could collect. You collect stamps, or you could collect coins, or, you know, or whatever. Natsuke dolls. But this guy collects two odd things. One of which is knives, but the one I want to talk about, he doesn't use the knife, but he likes the beautifully handcrafted knives. But he also collects wooden bowls, of all things. And I asked him, I said, why is that such a rewarding thing? He said, well, first of all, it's kind of useful. The bowls are useful, but they're also just beautifully handcrafted. And you also get to learn there's all kinds of different woods. And it's fun to learn about all the woods. You know, it wouldn't be my thing, but it gave him something to really get into. And then he found out that there are auctions that are exciting to get the kind of bowl he wanted, the bowls he wanted. And then there are vendors who are, and other users who are obsessed with it. So there are online forums where he would talk to people. And so it became a whole way of life, wooden bowls. Now, of course, there's everything in a million years, everything else you could find yourself collecting. But it's an example of a less conventional kind of an activity that is a distraction from aging. I think this is probably as good a time as any to let you know you're listening to How to Do Life with I'm Marty Nemko. If you're listening to it, you may be listening to it on the podcast from or the broadcast from KSFP, or you're watching on YouTube. Stay with me. I'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to How to Do Life with Marty Nemko. You can email Dr. Marty Nemko with your comments and questions at mnemko@comcast.net. Or for his articles and books, visit martynemko.com. That's martynemko.com. Now back to How to Do Life.
Thanks for staying with me. I want to talk about an uncomfortable topic, of course, which is sex drive. You know, I did speak generically about loss of physical ability and mental ability. But one of the physical abilities that we lose at some point, some people much earlier than others in their 50s, others in their 60s, 70s, or 80s, but at some point we lose our sex drive. And of course, that's, you know, many people appropriately grieve that, because for many people, sex is among life's most enjoyable and even spiritually rewarding activities. I have another client who told me that he actually is grateful that he's lost his sex drive. He lost his sex drive in his late 60s. You know, it was gradual, but by the time he reached his late 60s, he had pretty damn low sex drive. And he said the biggest upside is, instead of always feeling, even if I wasn't going to act on it, he was single, he was always looking at a woman based on her looks and her sexual attractiveness and what it would be like to go after her and should I do it and should I not. It was a big distraction, and physically a physical distraction. But as his sex drive faded, he was able to see women in a light that many women, especially as they get older, appreciate. That they're much, much more than an object of sexual and romantic attraction. So he was able to have more meaningful relationships that were platonic. And he's developed a number of good friendships with women that are not sexual. And I'm reminded of, there was a movie, and I don't remember the name of it. I think it had Robert Redford and some other famous woman, a famous woman, co-ed. And it was about two old people who were just lonely. And they met as neighbors, and for a very long time were just having talks, and then they would lie in bed with each other, no sex. But it was an extremely comfortable, I think eventually they did have sex, but in whatever way an 80-year-old could have it. But they ended up finding an extremely rewarding relationship, and maybe a relationship that's more rewarding than the typical sexual relationship, which may be too centered around sex. I don't know, just a thought. And now I think I want to turn to the most difficult topic, facing dying and facing death. Well, dying we've already talked about, you know, I'll talk about it a little bit, you know, trying to distract yourself with activities or whatever, but especially if you're in pain and you're in dying, you can't deny it. You've got to face it. You may be, you know, those Elizabeth Kübler-Ross stages, you may be angry and denying it, and then, but finally there's, you may reach some kind of acceptance, calm or not. Of course, I'm grateful to be living in a state that when that does come time for me, that the state does allow for physician-assisted suicide, I guess it's called there. I think they have another name for it they like better. It's more politically correct, I don't know. But, you know, certainly, unless your religion is really strongly against taking your own life, I've seen and heard about too many people who, with end-stage disease, suffer, you know. Too often, some doctors are hell-bent on trying to save the patient, make the patient live longer at all costs, even if the quality of life is terrible. And some don't even deep down internally believe that there's going to be much more life or quality of life, but can't bear to tell the truth to the patient. And then the patient suffers a lot through those heroic, quote, treatments. You know, both from a selfish perspective, and maybe even, you know, again, many liberals among us are very self-sacrificial and realize that they say that huge percentages of medical expenses are spent in the last 6 months of life. And especially as we're going to be moving to providing health care for everybody in this country, one of the best forms of self-rationing is realizing at the end, those last 6 months, is it worth the tens and tens and tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars of cost, which you may not pay out of pocket, or you may, some of it, but which the taxpayer will pay, or the other people insured will have raised premiums because of it, whether it's because you don't want to put yourself through the torture, or because you want to save the people who would be paying for this, the money, and maybe saving your family the grief. It ain't fun to be spending those painful last few months, if you've had a, you know, a vegetative stroke or bad cancer or whatever, and your family has got to deal with you and try to be supportive and not let their sadness show too much. It's very difficult for family members psychologically and practically. So one of the most maybe, well, certainly can say this, the final big act that you have in your life is deciding when to say enough is enough for yourself, for your family, and for society, for the healthcare system, which is ever more a system. It's not, we've long passed individual pay for service. So I would encourage you to think about using those end-of-life options where you can peacefully, hopefully if you're in a state which allows it, with a physician assistance, you can end your life before the horrible pain things happens. And every state's different. A number of states will allow it under some conditions, and you just might want to look that up for your state when that comes time. We've got some more time left, so what do I want to talk about? I've got another 7 minutes or so. So I would like to talk about, older people in the way in which you interact with your grandkids and your children. It's one of the more ticklish subjects of all, because the parents of children are very proprietary, generally, about how that child should be parented. And the grandparent, you know, may default to spoiling, or if the grandparent sees their child parenting with, in the way they believe, too poorly, either because they're too strict or too lenient or too inconsistent, or, you know, won't allow them to have a dog, it can drive the grandparent nuts, and the grandparent feels very tempted to say something. I am aware that the conventional wisdom is shut up, stay out of it. Grandparents' job is merely to hug the kid, be nice, take him to the zoo, etc., read stories to him, babysit. But I do think, as I think in most situations, tactful feedback offered in a suggesting way, not an ordering way, and in a way that's face-saving, is net worth incurring what your children might say. It's my child, don't tell me how to parent. I think it's worth risking some measure of that. So I would invite you, as you see your children parenting their children, to think about, is it worth taking the risk of tactfully speaking up? You know, for example, I'll just try to role play one. So, Mary, I know it's so difficult being a parent. You're working full time, your husband is working full time, and when you get home, the last thing you want to do is be consistent. It's so tempting when your kid is just saying, I want, or whatever. I don't want to come to the table. I want this. Give me the toy. I want it. It's my toy. To give in. And I could see, you know, I'm sure that when I was a parent, I did that with you sometimes. But I've noticed that sometimes you and your husband are on opposite sides of the issue. And you tend to give in, and he tends to try to hold the line, so the kid gets a mixed message, and also gets the message that you're a soft touch, and that daddy is mean, that he's always saying no. I'm wondering if you've had, I'm sure you've tried this at least once, probably more, but I'm wondering if you, it's worth another sit down between you and your husband to kind of get on the same page about what's going to be acceptable and what's not going to be acceptable. And well, of course, you don't have to be perfect, but if you at least go into the maelstrom of parenting with some agreement on the general tenor of the way in which you're going to parent, it can really help. What else? Now I want to talk about, let's see, being older and looks. I guess I want to talk about looks. My mom, when she was 80, I can say it now because she's gone, she went and had a facelift. And she, and I said, why are you doing this? She says, you know, I know, Martin, you don't care much about your looks, but unless I'm looking good, I don't feel alive. When my hair is good, when my face is younger, even at age 80, I'm getting male attention and I like it. So my mother, all the way until the very end, when, you know, she declined it, she died at almost 90. She did her hair, she had her makeup on, and she had that facelift at age 80. I'm not saying that all of you should do that, But I am saying that especially as you get older, there is a luxury you have, which is you don't have to follow the norms as much. When you're a teenager, you tend to be obsessed with what everybody else is doing. And when you're in the middle of your working years, you figure you got to play along with the rules of the game, the rules of being politically correct or how to manage in a way that's acceptable, look the certain way, say the right things at parties, how, you know, drive the right car, live in the right neighborhood, all that crap. But when you're older, that should become less important because you know that your years on the planet are less. So think about what you really want to do with regard to your looks, with regard to anything. You know, maybe, you know, you decide you, maybe you've been, again, I'm thinking in very Bay Area terms, there's many, many Bay Area people who are, whose liberal politics make them very not materialistic. And so they live very modestly, even if they can afford to spend more. But just possibly, as you reach your 60s, 70s, 80s, and you're fortunate enough or have been disciplined enough and lucky enough to have saved some serious money, is it time to loosen the purse strings? Or the other way around, if you've done the typical American materialistic thing and you've got the fancy house and the fancy cars and the jewelry and the fancy vacations and all that crap, forgive me for saying it, but I tend to be critical of the, what I'll call the Rolex and Gucci lifestyle. You know, now is your time to change. As you're older, you're going to have less repercussions in your career and your relationships, and you don't give a damn. At some point, you say, you know what? I got to be me and do what I want. So let me ask you that. What do you want to do in terms of work? Do you want to just, in your 70s, just want to sit around? Some people do, and watch TV and not feel guilty about it. Others want to do a lot of volunteering or collecting or time with grandkids or not time with grandkids. For example, I love my grandchildren, but I don't like travel. They live 3,000 miles away. And so I like to connect with them by, you know, Skype and FaceTime and writing to them. And yes, when they've got a big thing like my one of my granddaughters is going to be in the Nutcracker in the Washington Ballet, I want to fly in to see that. But I'm not of the every 6 week variety where I'm flying into to DC from here in California. That doesn't mean I don't love them. But the point is, as you get older, you're entitled to more distinctiveness. And I encourage you, and maybe that's a good way for me to end. One of the few silver linings, it ain't no golden years, but one of the few silver linings of getting older is you may feel less need to please other people. When I die, for example, I would like to die in front of my computer too. The point is, do it your way. So, and with that, I'll simply say, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For comments on the show or to consult with Marty Nemco, his email address is mnemko@comcast.net. How to Do Life is produced by Marty Nemco. Post-production, Mel Baker. Music from the Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening.